Jesus, such a mimic would become the copied person. Odrade's reports on the face dancer Tuek were highly suggestive. Even the Tlelaxu masters might not be able to shake such a face dancer out of its mimic shape and behavior. And its beliefs. Damn, Odrade! She had painted her sisters into a corner. They had no choice except to follow Odrade's lead, and Odrade knew it. How did she know it? Was it that wild talent again? I cannot act blindly. I must know. Terraza went through the well-remembered regimen to restore a sense of calm. She dared not make momentous decisions in a frustrated mood. A long look at the statuette of Chenua helped. Lifting herself from the chair dog, Terraza returned to her favorite window. It often soothed her to stare out at this landscape, observing how the distances changed with the daily movement of sunlight and shifts in the planet's well-managed weather. Hunger prodded her. I will eat with the acolytes and lay sisters today. It helped at times to gather the young around her and remember the persistence of the eating rituals, the daily timing, morning, noon, and evening. That formed a reliable cement. She enjoyed watching her people. They were like a tide, speaking of deeper things, of unseen forces and greater powers that persisted because the Bene Gesserit had found the ways of flowing with that persistence. These thoughts renewed Terraza's balance. Nagging questions could be placed temporarily at a distance. She could look at them without passion. Odrade and the tyrant were right. Without noble purpose, we are nothing. One could not escape, though, the fact that critical decisions were being made on Rakkas by a person who suffered from those recurring Atreides flaws. Odrade had always displayed typical Atreides weakness. She had been positively benevolent to erring acolytes. Affections developed out of such behavior. Dangerous and mind-clouding affections. This weakened others who then were required to compensate for such laxity. More competent sisters were called upon to take erring acolytes in hand and correct the weaknesses. Of course, Odrade's behavior had exposed these flaws in acolytes. One must admit this. Perhaps Odrade reasoned thus. When she thought this way, something subtle and powerful shifted in Terraza's perceptions. She was forced to put down a deep sense of loneliness. It rankled. Melancholy could be quite as mind-clouding as affection, or even love. Terraza and her watchful memory sisters ascribed such emotional responses to awareness of mortality. She was forced to confront the fact that one day she would be no more than a set of memories in someone else's living flesh. Memories and accidental discoveries, she saw, had made her vulnerable, and just when she needed every available faculty. But I am not yet dead. Terraza knew how to restore herself. And she knew the consequences. Always, after these bouts of melancholy, she regained an even firmer grip on her life and its purposes. Odrade's flawed behavior was a source of her mother superior's strength. Odrade knew it. Terraza smiled grimly at this awareness. The mother superior's authority over her sisters always became stronger when she returned from melancholy. Others had observed this, but only Odrade knew about the rage. There! Terraza realized that she had confronted the distressful seeds of her frustration. Odrade had clearly recognized on several occasions what sat at the core of the Mother Superior's behavior, a giant howl of rage against the uses others had made of her life. The power of that suppressed rage was daunting, even though it could never be expressed in a way that vented it. That rage must never be allowed to heal. How it hurt! Odrade's awareness made the pain even more intense. Such things did what they were supposed to do, of course. Bene Gesserit impositions developed certain mental muscles. They built up layers of callousness that could never be revealed to outsiders. Love was one of the most dangerous forces in the universe. They had to protect themselves against it. A reverend mother could never become intimately personal, not even in the services of the Bene Gesserit. Simulation. We play the necessary role that saves us. The Bene Gesserit will persist. How long would they be subservient this time? Another 3,500 years? Well, damn them all. It would still be only a temporary thing. Terraza turned her back on the window and its restorative view. She did feel restored. New strength flowed into her. There was strength enough to overcome that gnawing reluctance which had kept her from making the essential decision. I will go to Rakkus. She no longer could evade the source of her own reluctance. I may have to do what Belunda wants. Survival of self, of species, and of environment, these are what drive humans. You can observe how the order of importance changes in a lifetime. What are the things of immediate concern at a given age? Weather? The state of the digestion? Does she or he really care? All of those various hungers that flesh can sense and hope to satisfy. What else could possibly matter? Later the second to Hui Nori, his voice, Dares Balat. Miles Tegg awoke in darkness to find himself being carried on a litter sling supported by suspensors. By their faint energy glow, he could see the tiny suspensor bulbs in an up-dangling row around him. There was a gag in his mouth. His hands were securely tied behind his back. His eyes remained uncovered.
So they don't care what I see.
Who they were, he could not tell. The bobbing motions of the dark shapes around him suggested they were descending uneven terrain. A trail? The litter sling rode smoothly on its suspensors. He could sense the faint humming from the suspensors when his party stopped to negotiate the turn of a difficult passage. Now and then, through some intervening obstruction, he saw the flickering of a light ahead. They entered the lighted area presently and stopped. He saw a single glow globe about 3 meters off the ground, tethered on a pole and moving gently in a cold breeze. By its yellow glow he discerned a shack, in the center of a muddy clearing, many tracks in trampled snow. He saw bushes and a few sparse trees around the clearing. Someone passed a brighter hand light across his face. Nothing was said, but Tegg saw a hand gesture toward the shack. He had seldom seen such a dilapidated structure. It looked ready to collapse at the slightest touch. He bet himself that the roof leaked. Once more, his party lurched into motion, swinging him toward the shack. He studied his escort in the dim light, faces muffled to the eyes in a cover that obscured mouths and chins. Hoods hid their hair. The clothing was bulky and concealed body details except for the general articulation of arms and legs. The pole-tethered glow-globe went dark. A door opened in the shack, sending a brilliant glare across the clearing. His escort hustled him inside and left him there. He heard the door close behind them. It was almost blindingly bright inside after the darkness. Tegg blinked until his eyes adapted to the change. With an odd sense of displacement, he looked around him. He had expected the shack's interior to match its exterior, but here was a neat room almost bare of furnishings, only 3 chairs, a small table, and... He drew in a sharp breath. An Ixion probe. Couldn't they smell the shear on his breath? If they were that unaware, let them use the probe. It would be agony for him, but they would get nothing from his mind. Something clicked behind him, and he heard motion. 3 people came into his field of vision and ranged themselves around the foot of the litter. They stared at him silently. Tegg moved his attention across the 3. The one on his left wore a dark single suit with open lapels. Male. He had the squarish face Tegg had seen on some Gamu natives, small, beady eyes that stared straight through Tegg. It was the face of an inquisitor, one who would not be moved by your agony. The Harkonnens had imported a lot of those in their day. Single-purpose types who could create pain without the slightest change of expression. The one directly at Tegg's feet wore bulky clothing of black and grey similar to that of the escort, but the hood was thrown back to reveal a bland face under closely cropped grey hair. The face gave nothing away and the clothing revealed little. No telling if this one was male or female. Tegg recorded the face, wide forehead, square chin, large green eyes above an knife-ridged nose, a tiny mouth pursed around a mue of distaste. The 3rd member of this group held Tegg's attention longest. Tall, a tailored black single suit with a severe black jacket over it, perfectly fitted. Expensive. No decorations or insignia. Male, definitely. The man affected boredom, and this gave Tegg a tag for him. Narrow, supercilious face, brown eyes, thin-lipped mouth. Bored, bored, bored. All of this in here was an unwarranted demand on his very important time. He had vital business elsewhere, and these other two, these underlings, must be made to realize that.
That one, Teg thought, is the official observer.
The bored one had been sent by the masters of this place to watch and report what he saw. Where was his data case? Ah, yes, there it was, propped against the wall behind him. Those cases were like a badge for such functionaries. On his inspection tour, Teg had seen these people walking the streets of Yasai and other Gamu cities. Small, thin cases. The more important the functionary, the smaller the case. This one's case would barely contain a few data spools and a tiny comm eye. He would never be without an eye to link him with his superiors. Thin case. This was an important functionary. Teg found himself wondering what the observer would say if Teg asked,
"What will you tell them about my composure?"
The answer was already there on that bored face. He would not even answer. He was not here to answer. When this one leaves, Teg thought, he will walk with long strides. His attention will be on distances where only he knows what powers await him. He will slap that case against his leg to remind himself of his importance, and to call the attention of these others to his badge of authority. The bulky figure at Teg's feet spoke, a compelling voice and definitely female in those vibrant tones.
"See how he holds himself and watches us. Silence will not break him. I told you that before we entered. You are wasting our time, and we do not have all that much time for such nonsense."
Teg stared at her, something vaguely familiar in the voice. It had some of that compelling quality found in a reverend mother. Was that possible? The heavy-faced Gamu type nodded.
"You are right, Mateli. But I do not give the orders here."
Mateli? Teg wondered. Name or title?
Both of them looked at the functionary. That one turned and bent to his data case. He removed a small comm eye from it and stood with the screen concealed from his companions and Teg. The eye came alight with a green glow which cast a sickly illumination over the observer's features. His self-important smile vanished. He moved his lips silently, words formed only for someone on that eye to see. Teg hid his ability to read lips. Anyone trained by the Bene Gesserit could read lips from almost any angle where they were visible. This man spoke a version of Old Galak. "It is the Basha Teg for sure," he said. "I have made identification." The green light danced on the functionary's face while he stared into the eye. Whoever communicated with him was in agitated movement, if that light meant anything. Again, the functionary's lips moved soundlessly. "None of us doubts that he has been conditioned against pain, and I can smell sheer on him. He will—" He fell silent as the green light once more danced on his face. "I do not make excuses." His lips shaped the old Gallic words with care. "You know we will do our best, but I recommend that we pursue with vigor all other means of intercepting the Gola." The green light winked off. The functionary clipped the eye to his waist, turned toward his companions, and nodded once.
"The T-probe," the woman said.
They swung the probe over Teg's head. She called it a T-probe, Teg thought. He looked up at the hood as they brought it over him. There was no Ixion stamp on the thing. Teg experienced an odd sense of déjà vu. He had the feeling that his own captivity here had occurred many times before. No single incident déjà vu, it was a deeply familiar recognition, the captive and the interrogators. These three, the probe. He felt emptied. How could he know this moment? He had never personally employed a probe, but he had studied their use thoroughly. The Bene Gesserit often used pain but relied mostly on truth-sayers. Even more than that, the Sisterhood believed that some equipment could put them too much under Ixion influence. It was an admission of weakness, a sign that they could not do without such despicable devices. Teg had even suspected there was something in this attitude of a hangover from the Butlerian Jihad, rebellion against machines that could copy out the essence of a human's thoughts and memories.
Déjà vu.
Mentat logic demanded of him, "How do I know this moment?" He knew that he had never before been a captive. It was such a ridiculous switch of roles, the great Basha Teg a captive. He could almost smile. But that deep sense of familiarity persisted. His captors positioned the hood directly over his head and began releasing the Medusa contacts one at a time, fixing them to his scalp. The functionary watched his companion's work, producing small signs of impatience on an otherwise emotionless face. Teg moved his attention across the three faces. Which one of these would act the part of friend? Ah, yes, the one called Maeterli. Fascinating. Was it a form of honored matre? But neither of the others deferred to her as one would expect from what Teg had heard of those returning lost ones. These were people from the scattering, though, except possibly for the square-faced male in the brown single suit. Teg studied the woman with care, the mat of grey hair, the quiet composure in those widely spaced green eyes, the slightly protruding chin with its sense of solidity and reliability. She had been chosen well for friend. Maeterli's face was a map of respectability, someone you could trust. Teg saw a withdrawn quality in her, though. She was one who would also observe carefully to catch the moment when she must become involved. Surely she was Bene Gesserit, trained at the very least.
Or trained by the honored matres.
They finished attaching the contacts to his head. The Gamu type swung the probe's console into position where all three could watch the display. The probe's screen was concealed from Teg. The woman removed Teg's gag, confirming his judgment. She would be the source of comfort. He moved his tongue around in his mouth, restoring sensation. His face and chest still felt a bit numb from the stunner that had brought him down. How long ago had that been? But if he was to believe the silent words of the functionary, Duncan had escaped. The Gamu type looked to the observer.
You may begin, ya, the functionary said.
Ya? Teg wondered.
Curious name.
Almost had a Tleilaxu sound, but Yah was not a face dancer, or a Tleilaxu master. Too big for one, and no stigmata of the other. As one trained by the Sisterhood, Teg felt confident of this. Yah touched a control on the probe's console. Teg heard himself grunt with pain. Nothing had prepared him for that much pain. They must have turned their devil's machine to maximum for the first thrust. No question about it. They knew he was a Mentat. A Mentat could remove himself from some demands of flesh, but this was excruciating. He could not escape it. Agony shivered through his entire body, threatening to blank out his consciousness. Could Shear shield him from this? The pain diminished gradually and went away, leaving only quivering memories. Again. He thought suddenly that the spice agony must be like this for a reverend mother. Surely there could be no greater pain. He fought to remain silent, but heard himself grunting, moaning. Every ability he had ever learned, Mentat and Bene Gesserit, was called into play, keeping him from forming words, from begging for surcease, from promising to tell them anything if they would only stop. Once more the agony receded and then surged back. Enough! That was the woman. Teg groped for her name. Maeterli? Yah spoke in a sullen voice. He's loaded with Shear. Enough to last him a year, at least. He gestured at his console. Blank. Teg breathed in shallow gasps. The agony. It continued to increase despite Maeterli's demand.
I said enough,
Maeterli snapped. Such sincerity, Teg thought. He felt the pain recede, withdrawing as though every nerve were being removed from his body, pulled out like threads of the remembered agony.
It is wrong what we're doing, Maeterli said. This man is...
He is like any other man,
Yah said. Shall I attach the special contact to his penis?
Not while I'm here, Maeterli said.
Teg felt himself almost taken in by her sincerity. The last of the agony threads left his flesh and he lay there with a feeling that he had been suspended off the surface that supported him. The sense of déjà vu remained. He was here and not here. He had been here and he had not.
They will not like it if we fail,
Yah said.
Are you prepared to face them with another failure?
Maeterli shook her head sharply. She bent over to bring her face into Teg's line of vision through the Medusa tangle of probe contacts.
Bashar, I am sorry for what we do. Believe me, this is not of my making. Please, I find all of this disgusting. Tell us what we need to know and let me make you comfortable.
Teg formed a smile for her. She was good. He shifted his gaze to the watchful functionary.
Tell your masters for me. She is very good at this.
Blood darkened the functionary's face. He scowled.
Give him the maximum, Yah,
His voice was a clipped tenor, without any of the deep training apparent in Maeterli's voice.
"Please,"
Maeterli said. She straightened but kept her attention on Teg's eyes. Teg's Bene Gesserit teachers had taught him that.
Watch the eyes. Observe how they change focus. As the focus moves outward, the awareness moves inward.
He focused deliberately on her nose. It was not an ugly face, rather distinctive. He wondered what the figure might be under those bulky clothes.
Ja!
That was the functionary. Yar adjusted something on his console and pressed a switch. The agony that surged through Teg now told him the previous level had indeed been lower. With the new pain came an odd clarity. Teg found himself almost capable of removing his awareness from this intrusion. All of that pain was happening to someone else. He had found a haven where little touched him. There was pain, agony even. He accepted reports about these sensations. That was partly the Shear's doing, of course. He knew that and was thankful. Maeterli's voice intruded.
I think we're losing him. Better ease off.
Another voice responded, but the sound faded into stillness before Teg could identify the words. He realized abruptly that he had no anchor point for his awareness.
Stillness.
He thought he heard his heart beating rapidly in fear, but he was not sure. All was stillness, profound quiet with nothing behind it.
Am I still alive?
He found a heartbeat then, but no certainty that it was his own.
Thump, 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 thump.
It was a sensation of movement and no sound. He could not fix the source.
What is happening to me?
Words blazoned in brilliant white against a black background played across his visual centers.
I'm back to 1/3. Leave it at that. See if we can read him through his physical reactions. Can he still hear us? Not consciously.
None of Teg's instructions had told him a probe could do its evil work in the presence of Shear, but they called this a T-probe. Could bodily reactions provide a clue to suppressed thoughts? Were there revelations to be explored by physical means? Again, words played against Teg's visual centers.
Is he still isolated? Completely. Make sure. Take him a little deeper.
Teg tried to lift his awareness above his fears.
I must remain in control.
What might his body reveal if he had no contact with it? He could imagine what they were doing, and his mind registered panic, but his flesh could not feel it.
Isolate the subject. Give him nowhere to seat his identity.
Who had said that? Someone. The sense of déjà vu returned in full force.
I am a Mentat,
he reminded himself.
My mind and its workings are my center.
He possessed experiences and memories upon which a center could rely. Pain returned. Sounds.
Loud, much too loud.
He's hearing again.
That was Yar.
How can that be?
The functionary's tenor.
Perhaps you've set it too low,
Maeterli. Teg tried to open his eyes. The lids would not obey. He remembered then, they had called it a T-probe. This was no Ixion device. This was something from the scattering. He could identify where it took over his muscles and senses. It was like another person sharing his flesh, preempting his own reactive patterns. He allowed himself to follow the workings of this machine's intrusion. It was a hellish device. It could order him to blink, fart, gasp, shit, piss, anything. It could command his body as though he had no thinking part in his own behavior. He was relegated to the role of observer. Odors assailed him, disgusting odors. He would not command himself to frown, but he thought of frowning. That was sufficient. These odors had been elicited by the probe. It was playing his senses, learning them.
Do you still have enough to read him?
The functionary's tenor.
He's still hearing us.
Yar.
Damn all Mentats,
Maeterli.
Dit, dat, and dot,
Teg said, naming the puppets of the winter show from his childhood on long ago Linnaeus.
He's talking,
the functionary. Teg felt his awareness being blocked off by the machine. Yar was doing something at the console. Still, Teg knew his own Mentat logic had told him something vital. These three were puppets. Only the puppet masters were important. How the puppets moved, that told you what the puppet masters were doing. The probe continued to intrude. Despite the force being applied, Teg felt his awareness matching the thing. It was learning him, but he was also learning it. He understood now. The whole spectrum of his senses could be copied into this T-probe and identified, tagged for Yar to call up when needed. An organic chain of responses existed within Teg. The machine could trace those out as though it made a duplicate of him. The Shear and his Mentat resistance shunted the searchers away from his memories, but everything else could be copied.
"It will not think like me," he reassured himself.
The machine would not be the same as his nerves and flesh. It would not have Teg memories or Teg experiences. It had not been born of woman. It had never travelled down a birth canal and emerged into this astonishing universe. Part of Teg's awareness applied a memory marker, telling him that this observation revealed something about the Gola.
"Duncan was decanted from an axolotl tank."
The observation came to Teg with a sudden sharp biting of acid on his tongue.
"The T-probe again."
Teg allowed himself to flow through a multiple simultaneous awareness. He followed the T-probe's workings and continued to explore this observation about the Gola, all the while listening for Dit, Dat, and Dot. The three puppets were oddly silent. Yes, waiting for their T-probe to complete its task.
The Gola.
Duncan was an extension of cells that had been born of a woman impregnated by a man.
Machine and Gola.
Observation.
The machine cannot share that birth experience, except in a remotely vicarious way, sure to miss important personal nuances.
Just as it was missing other things in him right now. The T-probe was replaying smells. With each induced odor, memories revealed their presence in Teg's mind. He felt the great speed of the T-probe, but his own awareness lived outside of that headlong rushing search, able to entangle him for as long as he desired in the memories being called up here.
There.
That was the hot wax he had spilled on his left hand when only 14 and a student in the Bene Gesserit school. He recalled school and laboratory as though his only existence were there at this moment.
The school is attached to Chapter House.
By being admitted here, Teg knew he had the blood of Siona in his veins. No prescient could track him here. He saw the lab and smelled the wax, a compound of artificial esters and the natural product of bees kept by failed sisters and their helpers. He turned his memory to a moment when he watched bees and people at their labours in the apple orchards. The workings of the Bene Gesserit's social structure appeared so complicated until you saw through to the necessities. Food, clothing, warmth, communication, learning, protection from enemies, a subset of the survival drive. Bene Gesserit survival took some adjustments before it could be understood. They did not procreate for the sake of humankind in general. No unmonitored racial involvement. They procreated to extend their own powers, to continue the Bene Gesserit, deeming that a sufficient service to humankind. Perhaps it was. Procreative motivation went deep, and the sisterhood was so thorough. A new smell assailed him. He recognized the wet wool of his clothing as he came into the command pod after the Battle of Ponciard. The smell filled his nostrils and elicited the ozone of the pod's instruments, the sweat of the other occupants.
Wool.
The sisterhood had always thought it a bit odd of him, the way he preferred natural fabrics and shunned the synthetics turned out in captive factories. No more did he care for chair dogs.
I don't like the smells of oppression in any form.
Did these puppets, Dit, Dat, and Dot, know how oppressed they were? Mentat Logic sneered at him. Were not wool fabrics also a product of captive factories? It was different. Part of him argued otherwise. Synthetics could be stored almost indefinitely. Look how long they had endured in the null entropy bins of the Harkonnen's no-globe.
I still prefer woolens and cottons.
So be it.
But how did I come by such a preference? It is an Atreides prejudice. You inherited it.
Teg shunted the smells aside and concentrated on the total movement of the intrusive probe. He found presently that he could anticipate the thing. It was a new muscle. He allowed himself to flex it while he continued to examine the induced memories for valuable insights.
I sit outside my mother's door on Leonaeus.
Teg removed part of his awareness and watched the scene, age 11. He is talking to a small Bene Gesserit acolyte who came as part of the escort for somebody important. The acolyte is a tiny thing with red blonde hair and a doll's face. Upturned nose, green-grey eyes. The S.I., is a black-robed reverend mother of truly ancient appearance. She has gone behind that nearby door with Teg's mother. The acolyte, who is named Kalana, is trying her fledgling skills on the young son of the house. Before Kalana utters 20 words, Miles Teg recognizes the pattern. She is trying to pry information out of him. This was one of the first lessons in delicate dissembling taught by his mother. There were, after all, people who might question a young boy about a reverend mother's household, hoping thereby to gain saleable information. There is always a market for data about reverend mothers. His mother explained, "You judge the questioner and fit your responses according to the susceptibilities." None of this would have served against a full reverend mother, but against an acolyte, especially this one. For Kalana, he produced an appearance of coy reluctance. Kalana has an inflated view of her own attractions. He allows her to overcome his reluctance after a suitable marshalling of her forces. What she gets is a handful of lies, which, if she ever repeats them to the S.I. behind that closed door, are sure to win Kalana a severe censuring, if not something more painful.
"Words from Dit, Dat, and Dot. I think we have him now."
Teg recognized Yar's voice yanking him out of old memories.
"Fit your responses according to the susceptibilities."
Teg heard the words in his mother's voice.
"Puppets. Puppet masters."
The functionary speaks.
"Ask the simulation where they have taken the Gola."
Silence and then a faint humming.
"I'm not getting anything."
"Yar."
Teg hears their voices with painful sensitivity. He forces his eyes to open against the opposing commands of the probe.
"Look,"
Yar says. Three sets of eyes stare back at Teg. How slowly they move. Dit, Dat, and Dot. The eyes go blink, blink, at least a minute between blinks. Yar is reaching for something on his console. His fingers will take a week to reach their destination. Teg explores the bindings on his hands and arms. Ordinary ropes. Taking his time, he squirms his fingers into contact with the knots. They loosen, slowly at first, and then flying apart. He moves onto the straps holding him to the sling litter. These are easier, simple slip locks. Yar's hand is not even a fourth of the way to the console. Blink, blink, blink. The three sets of eyes show faint surprise. Teg releases himself from the Medusa tangle of probe contacts. Pop, pop, pop. The grippers fly away from him. He is surprised to notice a slow start of bleeding on the back of his right hand where it has brushed the probe contacts aside. Mentat projection.
"I am moving with dangerous speed."
But now he is off the litter. Functionary is reaching a slow, slow hand toward a bulge in a side pocket. Teg's hand crushes the functionary's throat. Functionary will never again touch that little laser gun he always carries. Yar's outstretched hand is still not a third of the way to the probe console. There is definite surprise in his eyes, though. Teg doubts that the man even sees the hand that breaks his neck. Maeterli is moving a bit faster. Her left foot is coming toward where Teg had been just the flick of an instant previously, still too slow. Maeterli's head is thrown back, the throat exposed for Teg's down-chopping hand.
How slowly they fall to the floor.
Teg became aware of perspiration pouring from him, but he could not spare time to worry about this.
"I knew every move they would make before they made it. What has happened to me?"
Mentat projection.
"The probe agony has lifted me to a new level of ability."
Intense hunger pangs made him aware of the energy drain. He pushed the sensation aside, feeling himself return to a normal time beat. Three dull sounds. Bodies falling to the floor. Teg examined the probe console. Definitely not Ixion. Similar controls, though. He shorted out the data storage system, erasing it.
Room lights?
Controls beside the door from the outside. He extinguished the lights, took three deep breaths. A whirling blur of motion erupted into the night. The ones who had brought him here, clad in their bulky clothing against the winter chill, barely had time to turn toward the odd sound before the whirling blur struck them down. Teg returned to normal time beat more quickly. Starlight showed him a trail leading downslope through thick brush. He slipped and slid on the snow-churned mud for a space and then found the way to balance himself, anticipating the terrain. each step went where he knew it must go. He found himself presently in an open space that looked out across a valley. The lights of a city, and a great black rectangle of building near the center. He knew this place. Yasai, the puppet masters, were there.
I am free.
There was a man who sat each day looking out through a narrow vertical opening where a single board had been removed from a tall wooden fence. Each day a wild ass of the desert passed outside the fence and across the narrow opening. First the nose, then the head, the forelegs, the long brown back, the hind legs, and lastly the tail. One day the man leaped to his feet with a light of discovery in his eyes, and he shouted for all who could hear him, "It is obvious! The nose causes the tail!" Stories of the Hidden Wisdom, from the Oral History of Rakkus. Several times since coming to Rakkus, Audrade had found herself caught in the memory of that ancient painting which occupied such a prominent place on the wall of Terraza's chapter house quarters. When the memory came, she felt her hands tingle to the touch of the brush. Her nostrils swelled to the induced smells of oils and pigments. Her emotions assaulted the canvas. Each time Audrade emerged from the memory with new doubts that Shiana was her canvas.
Which of us paints the other?
It had happened again this morning. Still dark outside the Rakkian keep's penthouse where she quartered with Shiana, an acolyte entered softly to waken Audrade and tell her that Terraza would arrive shortly. Audrade looked up at the softly illuminated face of the dark-haired acolyte, and immediately that memory painting flashed into her awareness.
Which of us truly creates another?
Let Shiana sleep a bit longer, Audrade said before dismissing the acolyte.
Will you breakfast before the Mother Superior's arrival?
The acolyte asked. We will wait upon Terraza's pleasure.
Arising, Audrade went through a swift toilet and donned her best black robe. She strode then to the east window of the penthouse common room and looked out in the direction of the space field. Many moving lights cast a glow on the dusty sky there. She activated all of the room's glow globes to soften the exterior view. The globes became reflected golden starbursts on the thick armor plaths of the windows. The dusky surface also reflected a dim outline of her own features, showing the fatigue lines clearly.
I knew she would come, Audrade thought.
Even as she thought this, the Rakkian sun came over the dust-blurred horizon like a child's orange ball thrust into view. Immediately, there was a heat bounce that so many observers of Rakkus had mentioned. Audrade turned away from the view and saw the hall door open. Terraza entered with a rustle of robes. A hand closed the door behind her, leaving the two of them alone. The Mother Superior advanced on Audrade, black hood up and the cowl framing her face. It was not a reassuring sight. Recognizing the disturbance in Audrade, Terraza played on it.
Well, da, I think we finally meet as strangers.
The effect of Terraza's words startled Audrade. She correctly interpreted the threat, but fear left her, spilling out as though it were water poured from a jug. For the first time in her life, Audrade recognized the precise moment of crossing a dividing line. This was a line whose existence she thought few of her sisters suspected. As she crossed it, she realized that she had always known it was there, a place where she could enter the void and float free. She no longer was vulnerable. She could be killed, but she could not be defeated.
So it's not Dar and Tar anymore, Audrade said.
Terraza heard the clear, uninhibited tone of Audrade's voice and interpreted this as confidence.
Perhaps it never was Dar and Tar, she said, her voice icy. I see that you think you have been extremely clever.
The battle has been joined, Audrade thought, but I do not stand in the path of her attack.
Audrade said, the alternatives to alliance with the Tleilaxu could not be accepted, especially when I recognized what it was you truly sought for us.
Terraza felt suddenly weary. It had been a long trip despite the space-folding leaps of her no-ship. The flesh always knew when it had been twisted out of its familiar rhythms. She chose a soft divan and sat down, sighing in the luxurious comfort. Audrade recognized the Mother Superior's fatigue and felt immediate sympathy. There were suddenly two reverend mothers with common problems. Terraza obviously sensed this. She patted the cushion beside her and waited for Adraid to be seated.
"We must preserve the sisterhood," Terraza said. "That is the only important thing."
"Of course."
Terraza fixed her gaze searchingly on Odraid's familiar features.
"Yes, Odraid too is weary. You have been here intimately touching the people and the problem," Terraza said. "I want... No, Dar. I need your views."
"The Tleilaxu give the appearance of full cooperation," Odraid said, "but there is dissembling in this. I have begun to ask myself some extremely disturbing questions."
"Such as?
What if the axolotl tanks are not... tanks?
What do you mean?"
"Woff reveals the kinds of behavior you see when a family tries to conceal a deformed child, or a mad uncle. I swear to you, he is embarrassed when we begin to touch on the tanks."
"But what could they possibly..."
"Surrogate mothers."
"But they would have to be..."
Terraza fell silent, shocked by the possibilities this question opened.
"Who has ever seen a Tleilaxu female?" Odraid asked.
Terraza's mind was filled with objections.
"But the precise chemical control, the need to limit variables..."
She threw her hood back and shook her hair free.
"You are correct. We must question everything. This, though, this is monstrous."
"He is still not telling the full truth about Argola."
"What does he say?"
"No more than what I have already reported. A variation on the original Duncan Idaho, and meeting all of the Pranabindu requirements we specified."
"That does not explain why they killed or tried to kill our previous purchases."
"He swears the holy oath of the great belief that they acted out of shame because the 11 previous Golas did not live up to expectations."
"How could they know? Does he suggest they have spies among—"
"He swears not. I taxed him with this, and he said that a successful Gola would be sure to create a visible disturbance among us."
"What visible disturbance? What is he—"
"He will not say." "Where is the Gola Tower?"
"What? Oh, on Gamu.
I hear rumors of—"
"Basmali has the situation well in hand."
Terraza closed her mouth tightly, hoping that was the truth. The most recent report did not fill her with confidence.
"You obviously are debating whether to have the Gola killed," Odraid said.
"Not just the Gola."
Odraid smiled.
"Then it's true that Belonda wants me permanently eliminated.
How did you—"
"Friendships can be a very valuable asset at times, Dar."
"You tread on dangerous ground, Reverend Mother Odraid."
"But I am not stumbling, Mother Superior Terraza. I am thinking long, hard thoughts about the things Waff has revealed about those honored matres."
"Tell me some of your thoughts."
There was implacable determination in Terraza's voice.
"Let us make no mistakes about this," Odraid said. "They have surpassed the sexual skills of our imprinters."
"Whores?"
"Yes, they employ their skills in a way ultimately fatal to themselves and others. They have been blinded by their own power."
"Is that the extent of your long, hard thoughts?"
"Tell me, Ta, why did they attack and obliterate our keep on Gamu?"
"Obviously, they were after our Idaho Gola. To capture him or kill him."
"Why would that be so important to them?"
"What are you trying to say?" Terraza demanded.
"Could the whores have been acting upon information revealed to them by the Tleilaxu?" "Ta, what if this secret thing Waff's people have introduced into our Gola is something that would make the Gola a male equivalent of the honored matres?"
Terraza put a hand to her mouth and dropped it quickly when she saw how much the gesture revealed. It was too late. No matter. They were still two reverend mothers together. Odraid said,
"And we have ordered Lucilla to make him irresistible to most women."
"How long have the Tleilaxu been dealing with those whores?" Terraza demanded.
Odraid shrugged.
"A better question is this. How long have they been dealing with their own lost ones returned from the scattering? Tleilaxu speak to Tleilaxu, and many secrets could be revealed."
"A brilliant projection on your part," Terraza said. "What probability value do you attach to it?"
"You know that as well as I do. It would explain many things."
Terraza spoke bitterly.
"What do you think of your alliance with the Tleilaxu now?"
"More necessary than ever. We must be on the inside. We must be where we can influence those who contend."
Abomination, Terraza snapped.
What?
This Gola is like a recording device in human shape. They have planted him in our midst. If the Trelaxu get their hands on him, they will know many things about us.
That would be clumsy.
And typical of them.
I agree that there are other implications in our situation, Odraid said, but such arguments only tell me that we dare not kill the Gola until we have examined him ourselves.
That might be too late. Damn your alliance, Dar! You gave them a hold on us, and us a hold on them, and neither of us dares let go.
Is that not the perfect alliance?
Terraza sighed.
How soon must we give them access to our breeding records?
Soon. Waff is pressing the matter.
Then will we see their axolotl tanks?
That is, of course, the lever I am using. He has given us reluctant agreement.
Deeper and deeper into each other's pockets, Terraza growled.
Her tone all innocence, Odraid said,
a perfect alliance, just as I said.
Damn, 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 Terraza muttered. And Teg has reawakened the Gola's original memories.
But has Lucilla?
I don't know.
Terraza turned a grim expression on Odraid and recounted the most recent reports from Gamo. Teg and his party located, the briefest of accounts about them and nothing from Lucilla. Plans made to bring them out. Her own words produced an unsettling picture in Terraza's mind. What was this Gola? They had always known the Duncan Idahos were not ordinary Golas. But now, with augmented nerve and muscle capabilities, plus this unknown thing that Lelaxu had introduced, it was like holding a burning club. You knew you might have to use the club for your own survival, but the flames approached at a terrifying speed. Odraid spoke in a musing tone.
Have you ever tried to imagine what it must be like for a Gola suddenly to awaken in renewed flesh?
What? What are you?
Realizing that your flesh was grown from the cells of a cadaver, Odraid said. He remembers his own death.
The Idahos were never ordinary people, Terraza said.
The same may be said for these Tlelaxu masters.
What are you trying to say?
Odraid rubbed her own forehead, taking a moment to review her thoughts. This was so difficult with someone who rejected affection, with someone who thrust outward from a core of rage. Terraza had no simpatico. She could not assume the flesh and senses of another except as an exercise in logic.
A Gola's awakening must be a shattering experience, Odraid said, lowering her hand. Only the ones with enormous mental resilience would survive.
We assume that the Thalaxu masters are more than they appear to be.
And the Duncan Idahos?
Of course. Why else would the tyrant keep buying them from the Thalaxu?
Odraid saw that the argument was pointless. She said,
The Idahos were notoriously loyal to the Atreides, and we must remember that I am Atreides.
You think loyalty will bind this one to you?
Especially after Lucilla.
That may be too dangerous.
Odraid sat back into a corner of the divan. Terraza wanted certainty, and the lives of the serial Golas were like melange, presenting a different taste in different surroundings. How could they be sure of their Gola?
The Tlelaxu meddle with the forces that produced our Kwisatz Haderach, Terraza muttered.
You think that's why they want our breeding records?
I don't know. Damn you, Dar, don't you see what you've done?
I think I had no choice, Odraid said.
Terraza produced a cold smile. Odraid's performance remained superb, but she needed to be put in her place.
You think I would have done the same?
Terraza asked.
She still does not see what has happened to me, Odraid thought.
Terraza had expected her pliant Dar to act with independence, but the extent of that independence had shaken the High Council. Terraza refused to see her own hand in this.
Customary practice, Odraid said.
The words struck Terraza like a slap in the face. Only the hard training of a Bene Gesserit lifetime prevented her from striking out violently at Odraid.
Customary practice.
How many times had Terraza herself revealed this as a source of irritation, a constant goad to her carefully capped rage? Odraid had heard it often. Odraid quoted the Mother Superior now.
Immovable custom is dangerous. Enemies can find a pattern and use it against you.
The words were forced from Terraza.
That is a weakness, yes.
Our enemies thought they knew our way, Odraid said. Even you, Mother Superior, thought you knew the limits within which I would perform. I was like Belonda. Before she even spoke, you knew what Belonda would say.
Have we made a mistake? Not elevating you above me?
Terraza asked. She spoke from her deepest allegiance.
No, Mother Superior. We walk a delicate path, but both of us can see where we must go.
Where is Waff now?
Terraza asked.
Asleep and well guarded.
Summon Shiana. We must decide whether to abort that part of the project.
And take our lumps?
As you say, Da.
Shiana was still sleepy and rubbing her eyes when she appeared in the common room, but she obviously had taken the time to splash water on her face and dress in a clean white robe. Her hair was still damp. Terraza and Odraid stood near an eastern window with their backs to the light.
This is Shiana, Mother Superior, Odraid said.
Shiana came fully alert with an abrupt stiffening of her back. She had heard of this powerful woman, this Terraza, who ruled the sisterhood from a distant citadel called Chapter House. Sunlight was bright in the window behind the two women, shining full into Shiana's face, dazzling her. It left the faces of the two reverend mothers partly obscured, the black outlines of their figures fuzzy in the brilliance. Acolyte instructors had prepared her against this encounter.
You stand at attention before the Mother Superior and speak respectfully. Respond only when she speaks to you.
Shiana stood at rigid attention the way she had been told.
I am informed that you may become one of us, Terraza said.
Both women could see the effect of this on the girl. By now, Shiana was more fully aware of her Reverend Mother's accomplishments. The powerful beam of truth had been focused on her. She had begun to grasp at the enormous body of knowledge the sisterhood had accumulated over the millennia. She had been told about selective memory transmission, about the workings of other memories, about the spice agony. And here before her stood the most powerful of all Reverend Mothers, one from whom nothing was hidden. When Shiana did not respond, Terraza said,
Have you nothing to say, child?
What is there to say, Mother Superior? You have said it all.
Terraza sent a searching glare at Odraid.
Have you any other little surprises for me, Da?
I told you she was superior, Odraid said.
Terraza returned her attention to Shiana.
Are you proud of that opinion, child?
It frightens me, Mother Superior.
Still holding her face as immobile as she could, Shiana breathed more easily.
Say only the deepest truth you can sense, she reminded herself.
Those warning words from a teacher carried more meaning now. She kept her eyes slightly unfocused and aimed at the floor directly in front of the two women, avoiding the worst of the brilliant sunlight. She still felt her heart beating too rapidly, and knew the Reverend Mothers would detect this. Odraid had demonstrated it many times.
Well, it should frighten you, Terraza said.
Odraid asked,
Do you understand what is being said to you, Shiana?
The Mother Superior wishes to know if I am fully committed to the sisterhood, Shiana said.
Odraid looked at Terraza and shrugged. There was no need for more discussion of this between them. That was the way of it when you were part of one family, as they were in the Bene Gesserit. Terraza continued her silent study of Shiana. It was a heavy gaze, energy draining for Shiana, who knew she must remain silent and permit that scorching examination. Odraid put down feelings of sympathy. Shiana was like herself as a young girl in so many ways. She had that globular intellect which expanded on all surfaces the way a balloon expanded when filled. Odraid recalled how her own teachers had been admiring of this, but wary just the way Terraza was now wary. Odraid had recognized this wariness, while even younger than Shiana, and held no doubts that Shiana saw it here. Intellect had its uses. Terraza said. Odraid heard the humming sound of the Mother Superior's internal reflections as part of a simul-flow. Odraid's own memory had surged backward. The sisters who had brought Odraid her food when she studied late had always loitered to observe her in their special way, just as Shiana was watched and monitored at all times. Odraid had known about those special ways of observing from an early age. That was, after all, one of the great lures of the Bene Gesserit. You wanted to be capable of such esoteric abilities. Shiana certainly possessed this desire. It was the dream of every postulant,
that such things might be possible for me.
Teraza spoke finally.
What is it you think you want from us, child? The same things you thought you wanted when you were my age, Mother Superior.
Odraid suppressed a smile. Shiana's wild sense of independence had skated close to insolence there, and Teraza certainly recognized this.
You think that is a proper use for the gift of life?
Teraza asked.
It is the only use I know, Mother Superior. Your candor is appreciated, but I warn you to be careful in your use of it,
Teraza said.
Yes, Mother Superior. You already owe us much, and you will owe us more,
Teraza said.
Remember that. Our gifts do not come cheaply.
Shiana has not the vaguest appreciation of what she will pay for our gifts, Odraid thought. The Sisterhood never let its initiates forget what they owed and must repay. You did not repay with love. Love was dangerous, and Shiana already was learning this. The gift of life? A shudder began to course through Odraid, and she cleared her throat to compensate.
Am I alive? Perhaps when they took me away from Amar Sabia, I died. I was alive there in that house, but did I live after the sisters removed me?
Teraza said,
You may leave us now, Shiana.
Shiana turned on one heel and left the room, but not before Odraid saw the tight smile on the young face. Shiana knew she had passed the Mother Superior's examination. When the door closed behind Shiana, Teraza said,
You mentioned her natural ability with voice.
I heard it, of course.
Remarkable.
She kept it well bridled, Odraid said. She has learned not to try it on us.
What do we have there, Dar?
Perhaps someday a Mother Superior of extraordinary abilities.
Not too extraordinary?
We will have to see.
Do you think she is capable of killing for us?
Odraid was startled and showed it.
Now?
Yes, of course.
The Gola?
Teg would not do it, Teraza said. I even have doubts about Lucilla. Their reports make it clear that he is capable of forging powerful bonds of affinity.
Even as I?
Shuang Yu herself was not completely immune.
Where is the noble purpose in such an act? Odraid asked. Isn't this what the tyrant's warning has
him? He killed many times.
And paid for it.
We pay for everything we take, Da.
Even for a life?
Never forget for one instant, Da, that a Mother Superior is capable of making any necessary decision for the Sisterhood's survival.
So be it, Odraid said. Take what you want and pay for it.
It was the proper reply, but it reinforced the new strength Odraid felt, this freedom to respond in her own way within a new universe. Where had such toughness originated? Was it something out of her cruel Bene Gesserit conditioning? Was it from her Atreides ancestry? She did not try to fool herself that this came from a decision never again to follow another's moral guidance rather than her own. This inner stability upon which she now stationed herself was not a pure morality. Not bravado, either. Those were never enough.
You are very like your father,
Teraza said.
Usually it's the dam who provides most of the courage, but this time I think it was the father.
Miles Teg is admirably courageous, but I think you oversimplify, Odraid said.
Perhaps I do. But I've been right about you at every turn, Dar. Even back there when we were student postulants.
She knows,
Odraid thought.
We don't need to explain it, Odraid said.
And she thought, it comes from being born who I am, trained and shaped the way I was, the way we both were, Dar and Tar.
It's something in the Atreides line that we have not fully analyzed,
Teraza said.
No genetic accidents?
I sometimes wonder if we've suffered any real accidents since the tyrant,
Teraza said.
Did he stretch out back there in his citadel and look across the millennia to this very moment?
How far back would you reach for the roots?
Teraza asked.
Odraid said, What really happens when a Mother Superior commands the breeding mistresses? Have that one go breed with that one.
Teraza produced a cold smile. Odraid felt herself suddenly at the crest of a wave, awareness pushing all of her over into this new realm.
Teraza wants my rebellion. She wants me as her opponent.
Will you see Waf now? Odraid asked.
First, I want your assessment of him.
He sees us as the ultimate tool to create the Tleilaxu ascendancy. We are God's gift to his people.
They have been waiting a long time for this, Terraza said, to dissemble so carefully all of them for all of those eons.
They have our view of time, O'Draid agreed. That was the final thing to convince them we share their great belief.
But why the clumsiness? Terraza asked. They are not stupid.
It diverted our attention from how they were really using their Gola process, O'Draid said. Who could believe stupid people would do such a thing?
And what have they created? Terraza asked.
Only the image of evil stupidity?
Act stupid long enough and you become stupid, O'Draid said. Perfect the mimicry of your face dancers and—
Whatever happens, we must punish them, Terraza said. I see that clearly. Have him brought up here.
After O'Draid had given the order, and while they waited, Terraza said,
The sequencing of the Gola's education became a shambles even before they escaped from the Gamu Keep. He leaped ahead of his teachers to grasp things that were only implied, and he did this at an alarmingly accelerated rate. Who knows what he has become by now?
Historians exercise great power, and some of them know it. They recreate the past, changing it to fit their own interpretations. Thus, they change the future as well. Leto II, his voice, from Dar es Balat. Duncan followed his guide through the dawn light at a punishing clip. The man might look old, but he was as springy as a gazelle and seemed incapable of tiring. Only a few minutes ago they had put aside their night goggles. Duncan was glad to be rid of them. Everything outside the reach of the glasses had been black in the dim starlight filtering through heavy branches. There had been no world ahead of him, beyond the range of the glasses. The view at both sides jerked and flowed. Now a clump of yellow bushes, now two silverbark trees, now a stone wall with a plasteel gate cut into it and guarded by the flickering blue of a burn shield, then an arched bridge of native rock all green and black underfoot. After that, an arched entry of polished white stone. The structures all appeared very old and expensive, maintained by costly handwork. Duncan had no idea where he was. None of this terrain recalled his memories of the long-lost Giri Prime days. Dawn revealed that they were following a tree-shielded animal track up a hillside. The climb became steep. Occasional glimpses through trees on their left revealed a valley. A hanging mist stood guard over the sky, hiding the distances, enclosing them as they climbed. Their world became progressively a smaller place as it lost its connection with a larger universe. At one brief pause, not for rest, but for listening to the forest around them, Duncan studied his mist-capped surroundings. He felt dislodged, removed from a universe that possessed sky and the open features that linked it to other planets. His disguise was simple. Tleilaxu cold-weather garments and cheek pads to make his face appear rounder. His curly black hair had been straightened by some chemical applied with heat. The hair was then bleached to a sandy blonde and hidden under a dark watch cap. All of his genital hair had been shaved away. He hardly recognized himself in the mirror they held up for him.
A dirty Tleilaxu.
The artisan who created this transformation was an old woman with glittering grey-green eyes.
You are now a Tleilaxu master, she said. Your name is Woze. A guide will take you to the next place. You will treat him like a face dancer if you meet strangers, otherwise do as he commands.
They led him out of the cave complex along a twisting passage, its walls and ceiling thick with the musky green algae. In starlighted darkness, they thrust him from the passage into a chilly night in the hands of an unseen man, a bulky figure in padded clothing. A voice behind Duncan whispered,
Here he is, Ambertorm. Get him through.
The guide spoke in an accent of gutturals.
Follow me.
He clipped a lead cord to Duncan's belt, adjusted the night goggles, and turned away. Duncan felt the cord tug once, and they were off. Duncan recognized the use of the cord. It was not something to keep him close behind. He could see this, Ambertorm, clearly enough with the night goggles. No, the cord was to spill him quickly if they met danger, no need for a command. For a long time during the night they crisscrossed small ice-lined watercourses on a flatland. The light of Gamu's early moons penetrated the covering growth only occasionally. They emerged finally onto a low hill with a view of bushy wasteland all silvery with snow cover in the moonlight. Down into this they went. The bushes, about twice the height of the guide, arched over muddy animal passages little larger than the tunnels where they had begun this journey. It was warmer here, the warmth of a compost heap. Almost no light penetrated to a ground spongy with rotted vegetation. Duncan inhaled the fungal odours of decomposing plant life. The night goggles showed him a seemingly endless repetition of thick growth on both sides. The cord linking him to Ambertorm was a tenuous grip on an alien world. Ambertorm discouraged conversation. He said,
"Yes,"
when Duncan asked confirmation of the man's name. Then,
"Don't talk."
The whole night was a disquieting traverse for Duncan. He did not like being thrown back into his own thoughts. Geedy prime memories persisted. This place was like nothing he remembered from his pre-Gola youth. He wondered how Ambertorm had learned the way through here, and how he remembered it. One animal tunnel appeared much like another. In the steady, jogging pace, there was time for Duncan's thoughts to roam. "Must I permit the Sisterhood to use me? What do I owe them?" And he thought of Teg, that last gallant stand to permit two of them to escape. "I did the same for Paul and Jessica." It was a bond with Teg, and it touched Duncan with grief. Teg was loyal to the Sisterhood. Did he buy my loyalty with that last brave act? Damn the Atreides! The night's exertions increased Duncan's familiarity with his new flesh. How young this body was. A small lurch of recollection, and he could see that last pre-Gola memory. He could feel the Sardauka blade strike his head, a blinding explosion of pain and light. Knowledge of his certain death. And then, nothing until that moment with Teg in the Harkonnen no-globe. The gift of another life. Was it more than a gift, or something less? The Atreides were demanding another payment from him. For a time, just before dawn, Ambertorm led him at a sloshing run along a narrow stream, whose icy chill penetrated the waterproof insulated boots of Duncan's Tlelaxu garments. The watercourse reflected bush-shadowed silver from the light of the planet's pre-dawn moon setting ahead of them. Daylight saw them come out into the larger, tree-shielded animal track and up the steep hill. This passage emerged onto a narrow, rocky ledge below a ridge top of saw-toothed boulders. Ambertorm led him behind a screen of dead brown bushes, their tops dirty with wind-blown snow. He released the cord from Duncan's belt. Directly in front of them was a shallow declivity in the rocks, not quite a cave, but Duncan saw that it would offer some protection unless they got a hard wind over the bushes behind them. There was no snow on the floor of the place. Ambertorm went to the back of the declivity and carefully removed a layer of icy dirt and several flat rocks, which concealed a small pit. He lifted a round black object from the pit and busied himself over it. Duncan squatted under the overhang and studied his guide. Ambertorm had a dished-in face, with skin like dark brown leather. Yes, those could be the features of a face dancer. Deep creases cut into the skin at the edges of the man's brown eyes. Creases radiated from the sides of the thin mouth and lined the wide brow. They spread out beside the flat nose and deepened the cleft of a narrow chin. Creases of time all over his face. Appetizing odors began to arise from the black object in front of Ambertorm.
"We will eat here, and wait a bit before we continue,"
Ambertorm said. He spoke Old Gaelic, but with that guttural accent, which Duncan had never heard before, an odd stress on adjacent vowels. Was Ambertorm from the Scattering, or a Gamu native? There obviously had been many linguistic drifts since the Dune days of Muad'Dib. For that matter, Duncan recognized that all of the people in the Gamu keep, including Teg and Lucilla, spoke a Gaelic that had shifted from the one he had learned as a pre-Gola child.
"Ambertorm," Duncan said.
"Is that a Gamu name?"
"You will call me Tormsa,"
the guide said.
"Is that a nickname?"
"It is what you will call me."
"Why did those people back there call you Ambertorm?"
"That was the name I gave them."
"But why would you—"
"You lived under the Harkonnens, and you did not learn how to change your identity?"
Duncan fell silent. Was that it? Another disguise? Tormsa had not changed his appearance. Tormsa.
Was it a Tlelaxu name? The guide extended a steaming cup toward Duncan.
A drink to restore you, Woz. Drink it fast. It will keep you warm.
Duncan closed both hands around the cup. Woz. Woz and Tormsa. Tlelaxu master and his face dancer companion. Duncan lifted the cup toward Tormsa in the ancient gesture of Atreides' battle comrades, then put it to his lips. Hot. But it warmed him as it went down. The drink had a faintly sweet flavor over some vegetable tang. He blew on it and drank it down as he saw Tormsa was doing. Odd that I should not suspect poison or some drug, Duncan thought. But this Tormsa and the others last night had something of the basher about them. The gesture to a battle comrade had come naturally.
Why are you risking your life this way? Duncan asked.
You know the Bashar, and you have to ask.
Duncan fell silent, abashed. Tormsa leaned forward and recovered Duncan's cup. Soon all evidence of their breakfast lay hidden under the concealing rocks and dirt. That food spoke of careful planning, Duncan thought. He turned and squatted on the cold ground. The mist was still out there beyond the screening bushes. Leafless limbs cut the view into odd bits and pieces. As he watched, the mist began to lift, revealing the blurred outlines of a city at the far edge of the valley. Tormsa squatted beside him.
Very old city, he said. Harkonnen place. Look.
He passed a small monoscope to Duncan.
That is where we go tonight.
Duncan put the monoscope to his left eye and tried to focus the oil lens. The controls felt unfamiliar, not at all like those he had learned as a pre-Gola youth or had been taught at the keep. He removed it from his eye and examined it.
Ixion?
He asked.
No. We made it.
Tormsa reached over and pointed out two tiny buttons raised above the black tube.
Slow. Fast. Push left to cycle out. Right to cycle back.
Again, Duncan lifted the scope to his eye. Who were the we who had made this thing? A touch of the fast button and the view leaped into his gaze. Tiny dots moved in the city. People. He increased the amplification. The people became small dolls. With them to give him scale, Duncan realized that the city at the valley's edge was immense, and farther away than he had thought. A single rectangular structure stood in the center of the city, its top lost in the clouds. Gigantic. Duncan knew this place now. The surroundings had changed, but that central structure lay fixed in his memory.
How many of us vanished into that black hellhole and never returned?
950 stories,
Tormsa said, seeing where Duncan's gaze was directed.
45 kilometers long.